Kairi Mai, Gorsandra Kailaho, and you're listening to Safe and Sound, an animal rights show broadcasting from Hamilton in Aotearoa, New Zealand. We're sponsored by Village Organics, who, by the way, have lots of fresh produce for your salads and lovely veggie roasts. They've also got melon juice and delicious maple water, so go and check them out. They're opposite the Frankton Hotel in Commerce Street, Frankton. I have a very special guest today who's made a unique mark in the world of philosophy and animal rights. He is Dr. Richard Ryder, who created the term speciesism. Since the 1960s, Richard has been active as a campaigner, activist, philosopher, ethicist, author, and political lobbyist for animals. His accomplishments are so many that in the short time we had available, we didn't cover half of them. I began the interview by asking Richard if, as an undergraduate psychology student at Cambridge University, the widespread experimentation on animals and psychological research at that time had an impact on his future work. We then went on to discuss how he coined the word speciesism and his early activism.
Yes, up to a point. I was already very interested in animals, always felt that they were my friends and equals throughout my teens, really. And when I went to Cambridge, I was shocked to discover how much psychology was to do with animal experimentation. Although I didn't do very much myself, I saw others, I saw animals kept in cages, I saw the effects of brain surgery and all that sort of thing. I read in the books the terrible descriptions of psychologists doing experiments on animals, giving them electric shock, blinding them, rearing them in deprived conditions and so on. It was pretty horrific stuff. And yes, it did. It brought matters to a head. But when I mentioned it to people at the time, they thought I was crazy. Yes. Nobody questioned the rights of human beings to behave in this way.
Didn't you have an association with the Oxford group?
Oh, yes. I worked as an undergraduate at Cambridge University and then moved across to work in a hospital in Oxford later on.
A psychiatric hospital, was it?
Yes, that's right. I was interested, of course, in various freedom movements of the 1960s, and we started using terms like racism and feminism and sexism for the first time. It struck me that we were missing out this whole category of the other animals. I was very much aware of the teachings of Charles Darwin, that we were all animals and we're all related through evolution. And it seemed to me to be strange that the other animals, the non-humans, were being left out of the picture. So I wanted to find another word that was similar to racism and sexism. So I invented speciesism.
Yes, it's a very powerful and meaningful term now. I mean, in the animal rights movement, we use it a lot to, for example, differentiate between the way we treat our companion animals compared with the way we treat animals who are farmed for food.
Yes, that's right. I started, really, when I was waiting for a patient who didn't come, and I read in the newspaper reports of some animal experiments back at the laboratory in Cambridge where I used to work. And so I wrote some letters off to the Daily Telegraph attacking animal experimentation. And this started a tremendous correspondence in the newspaper. And one of the people who joined in was the novelist Bridget Brophy. So Bridget got in touch with me and introduced me to Stanley and Rosalind Godlevich at Oxford. And they were young graduate philosophers. And so we met together and got to know each other. And I found at last somebody else I could discuss the philosophy with. And then I organized a number of demonstrations against animal experiments in the streets of Oxford, and a young chap called Andrew Lindsay turned up, and he was very much involved at that time. So we did several demonstrations against animal experiments in Oxford, and at the same time I started campaigning against blood sports, against otter hunting, the otters who lived in the rivers. And there were very few of them anyway because of the pollution of the rivers. And we were supported by a few environmentalists. And together we got the whole thing publicized, and we used various smells to try and make it difficult for the otter hounds to smell the otters. And we got some journalists there and got lots of photographs in the newspapers and the national press. We eventually outlawed otter hunting. I took about 2 or 3 years of demonstrations, and that was very effective.
But why did they want to hunt otters?
Oh, it was fun, you see. People chasing animals for fun, like they chase foxes for fun. I mean, I'm afraid human beings always find some animal that they can beat up and harass in various ways. Otters were one of them.
Is there still a lot of hunting in the UK?
Well, we had a huge campaign throughout the 1990s involving a battle in Parliament, which ended up in the hunting of wild animals using dogs. It is now illegal to hunt any wild animal using dogs. That was one of the biggest of the campaigns. But that only happened in the 1990s. Way back in the 1970s, nothing was protected, so we had to work for legislation. But again, first of all, we set up this little Oxford group, which consisted mainly of a handful of philosophers, and then eventually, of course, it attracted Peter Singer, who came over from Australia and came to Oxford and heard about the animal rights issue for the first time.
Maybe some conversations that you had with Peter contributed to Animal Liberation, the groundbreaking book on animal rights.
Yes, very much so. I used to discuss speciesism with Peter. He used to come out to my house just outside Oxford, and we used to have lunch or tea together, and we used to discuss it. And he then suggested that we should write a book, and I felt I didn't know enough about philosophy to contribute. So I turned down his kind offer of being co-author of Animal Liberation.
I see. Yeah. But you contributed to it in your way. I still remember to this day reading that book shortly after it came out, which is what, the mid-70s. I used to read it at night, lying in bed, propped up on my elbow, and having the stabs in my heart every page to think that we could treat animals that way. I really didn't know. I was already a vegetarian at that stage, but I had no idea the extent of the abuse. There's another book that had a real impact on me back in the mid to late 60s, and I wondered if it affected your own thinking, and that was The Naked Ape by Desmond Morris. Was that a seminal book for you?
It sounds strange to say it wasn't seminal, because I took it for granted that we were naked apes, that we were animals. I was very much convinced way back in the, I suppose, the 1950s, really, I was convinced that we were all animals and that we were completely overlooking the moral position of the other species, but also that we were belittling the intelligence of other animals and overlooking their
emotional
abilities. I always felt that the other animals were my friends and colleagues, you know. I didn't ever have this thing. But I very much enjoyed Desmond Morris's book. It was a superb book.
Yes.
And I met Desmond Morris on many occasions, and we used to discuss it all. He's a tremendous supporter of the campaigns against speciesism, and was one of the first, really, of the distinguished academics who supported animal rights in the 1960s and 1970s.
And it was very, very fringe back then. But I think that it was you who convened the world's first animal rights conference way back in 77. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. Another thing that started in the 1970s was that the RSPCA in England had become very tame. It had been taken over by the hunting people, and it wasn't doing any campaigning, wasn't attempting political reform. Because as you know, in the 1820s, it had been set up originally as a campaigning group, and it campaigned to introduce new legislation during the reign of Queen Victoria. And then, of course, the hunting people got worried about the RSPCA, so they took it over about the turn of the century, about 1900, and turned the RSPCA into a dogs and cats rescue organization.
Yes, yeah.
So there was then an attempt in 1972, I think it started, to recapture the RSPCA and return it to its original political role. And that was led by a group called, what was it called, the RSPCA Liberation Group. Mm. And it was extremely hard-fought battle. There were some very powerful people associated with the RSPCA at the time. And a group of about six of us managed to get onto the council of the RSPCA.
You were the chair, weren't you?
Yes, after a terrible lot of fighting, I managed to become chairman. And why am I telling you this? Oh, because that was actually one of the first things I did as chairman, was to convene an animal rights conference at Cambridge, which was very much disapproved of by many of the more conservative people on the RSPCA. But with, again, the help of Andrew Lindsay, we got a conference organized at Trinity College, Cambridge, in, I think, 1977, and we'd issued a declaration against speciesism at that time.
What kind of things did you discuss?
Somewhere, I've got the proceedings. It was published eventually. It's called Animal Rights, a Symposium, and we covered the whole field, really, of farm animal welfare, laboratory animal welfare, wild animal welfare, and pet animals.
Right.
And we had some very good speakers. Peter Singer had recently appeared on the scene, so we invited him to join in, and he did. That's right, he couldn't come to the conference itself. He wrote an introduction for us.
And you're quite a writer yourself. You've written a number of books.
Yes, about 10, I think. But my concern to start with was to clarify the philosophical position, the ethical position of animals. And so I spent some years clarifying that. And eventually there were sort of three strands to the modern philosophical movement. There was Peter Singer's, which was the traditional utilitarian argument. There was Tom Regan's, which was animal rights, the rights theory approach. And then there was mine, which was a combination of the two, if you like, slightly different from them, which I've called painism. It emphasizes the problems of pain, but it's more concerned about the individual than the utilitarian approaches.
Yes. In the world of animals, you get conservationists and scientists who are more concerned with species, with animals as part of a group rather than as individuals. So the emphasis is on the group, and therefore if you sacrifice some members of the group for the whole, then it doesn't matter.
That is precisely the sort of argument I've always thought, was wrong, you know. So I produced what I hope is a watertight argument the other way. The book that sums that up is called Speciesism, Painism, and Happiness.
I'll put a link to that book up on my Facebook page, and I certainly would like to read it myself, because I also focus on the individual animal who is so like us in many ways, and in particular that they feel pain and suffering. And that's also emotional and psychological pain, isn't it? It's not just physical
Absolutely. That was very much my position. And many of these, what seem to us today to be straightforward issues, in the 1960s and 1970s, there were still lots of people who denied that animals felt pain, for example. There were quite a lot of people around who were otherwise sensible and intelligent people who argued against that. And so I had to go back to square one and work all that out.
There's been a Facebook discussion recently. Some people were posting that they doubted that fish feel pain. So I wrote that you could settle the matter once and for all if you put a hook in the fish's mouth and dragged it through, say, a bathtub and watch its body language. And if it was nice and calm, then it wouldn't feel pain. But if it was flapping around, chances are that it's feeling a lot of pain. And then I said, and if you need a control group, please put the hook in your own mouth.
Yes, and, exactly.
And
have someone drag you.
And have someone drag you. This is Safe and Sound. I'm Sandra Kyle, and my guest today is Dr. Richard Ryder, a longtime animal activist and inventor of the term speciesism. As our discussion continues, I ask Richard to speak about how he played a part in getting the EU to recognise animal sentiency.
I set up something called Eurogroup for Animal Welfare when I was chairman of the RSPCA, and we put in hundreds of thousands of pounds into Eurogroup over the years. And it's done a wonderful job at securing some 40 pieces of legislation in the European Union since it was founded in 1980. Eurogroup often doesn't get the credit. It works with other organizations, and of course the outstanding one has been Compassion in World Farming. But together they've got these 40 pieces of legislation, and Article 13 of the treaty signed in Lisbon about 1990, was it? That includes the provision that we should respect animals because they are sentient, and that the welfare of animals should be considered in virtually all areas of European policy. Mm. And it was a great concern to us when, because of this Brexit decision of the British government, that we should lose this concern for sentiency in animals. And we found an ally in Michael Gove, who is one of the leading politicians in Britain, and he has shown a great deal of interest in animal welfare. I've had a meeting with him, along with other people, like David Thomas. Funnily enough, it was only 3 days ago that he produced a draft bill, Animal Welfare Sentencing and Recognition of Sentience Bill, that was drafted on the 12th of December, 2017, and that's going to reinstate, hopefully, this concern for the sentiency of animals throughout British law. It might hopefully go a step further than the European Union Article 13.
Of course, in New Zealand, we have enshrined in law now that animals are sentient beings, and there are some people who are pushing for personhood status for animals.
Great, that's wonderful. I'm very pleased you're doing that. I think New Zealand has done a lot to lead the world, actually. In my philosophy, any individual who can experience pain and suffering of any sort is automatically a person.
Yes.
So if you have an alien from outer space or a robot who can suffer pain, then they are a person.
You know, a mountain and a river can also be a person in law, so I don't know why animals cannot be persons. But in fact, it makes you wonder how it really does affect animals. We're still sending them off in their millions and millions and millions, transporting them in all weathers.
Terrible.
To the slaughterhouse, and we're still buying their body parts in supermarkets. So it's taking some time for people to make the connection. There's just another couple of things I want to get your ideas on. Referring to using farmed animals for food, I personally believe, and many vegans and animal rights people believe, that not using animals for food will benefit not only animals, but also people, because it will result in a kinder, a gentler, and more just society. I suspect you could agree with that.
Oh, yes, certainly. There's a tremendous interest in Britain at the moment in veganism.
Yes.
I mean, we thought way back when we started in the 1960s and 1970s, we couldn't argue about vegetarianism because we were made fun of. So we tended to concentrate on actually getting political results in other ways. But now there's a huge amount of interest in veganism, and it's tremendously important. And as you say, it's putting on the agenda the whole question of compassion.
Mm.
You know, there was an awful lot of people who were frightened to talk about compassion 30, 40 years ago. They thought it made them a bit sissy, worried about their manhood, you know, all that rubbish. And thank goodness that's disappearing now, and we're beginning to talk about compassion as the central issue in politics.
Yeah.
I hope it stays there.
Yes, definitely. Now, you're a psychologist, an ethicist, a philosopher, and also a very practical person, and you've made such a contribution. You've done so much. What do you think your main legacy will be?
Well, it's very very kind of you to say all that. I always felt that once I'd worked out the ethics, the philosophy, if you like, that I had to try and get that into legislation. When people say, you're a philosopher, I say, no, I'm not really. I'm really an animal politician. I've worked with the British Parliament. I've worked even with in Washington, even in Canberra. Funnily enough, I've never really worked with the New Zealand government, but it actually has been an attempt to get permanent changes into the structure of world politics. That's what I've tried to do. And we have had some success, thanks to the help of hundreds of compassionate politicians around the world.
Changes are brought about through law, but they're also brought about because of evolutionary pushes, aren't they? So if you consider that the zeitgeist of our times is our changing view of other sentient beings, we're being pushed, if you like, to stop using them and torturing them and imprisoning them and killing them when they fight until the end for their right to live, that we're actually evolving, consciously evolving beyond it. And this could also be evolution in progress.
I would like to think of it in those terms, Sandra. I think you're absolutely right. We're moving towards a more enlightened age. Moral implications of Charles Darwin have been around for 100 years. And yet people are only now beginning to face up to the fact that we've got to include in our moral and social community, we've got to include the other species too. And indeed, any visitors from outer space or robots who begin to feel pain and distress must be included in that same community. Yes. I absolutely agree with you. It's a huge step to take, but that's what hopefully we're going to achieve.
I hope so. And of course, you're associated with the wonderful Animal Interfaith Alliance. Barbara Gardner and Marian Hussenbucks have both been on the show, and you do really good work.
Absolutely. Barbara and Marian are doing superb work because they're bringing together people from all faiths, and they're finding in all the major religions to respect animals, to show compassion, to observe the golden rule. And that's what's such a wonderful thing which they're doing.
Richard, it sounds as if you haven't made many concessions to age. You're still involved in so many different areas. So I hope you look after yourself okay. Do you? You have a good diet?
Well, I don't know whether it's good for me or not, but certainly some of the battles for animal protection are quite tough and hard-going. I don't do as much as I used to do, but I'm still heavily involved, Thank you very much for saying all that.
And thank you for all that you have done, coining the word speciesism, and also for, 50 years working in various ways to help people to wake up to the fact that we share this planet with other animals, and those other animals have rights. They feel pain, physical and emotional pain, and what we do to them is not good, and we have to evolve beyond it. I think you're quite hopeful for the future as well, are you?
Yes, I am. I wrote a book called Animal Revolution, which looks at the history of the animal welfare movement, if you like, and what tends to encourage it is a level of affluence and also peace. You know, for the animals' sakes as well as our own, we want to avoid major war. It is, in a way, very encouraging, and I hope you're right that things are going to get better for the other animals.
We have many threats, don't we? One is from the possibility of nuclear war, and the other is climate change. We're living in times where there are many threats, not only to biodiversity, not only to other animals, but to human beings as well. But given that no real catastrophe happens, I still believe that the changing view of the other species that we share the planet with, our growing appreciation of them and respect for them and love for them, including farmed animals, including wild animals, is amounting to a sea change, a real and fundamental change that people like yourself have contributed so much too. And I'm really honoured that you've been on the show today, Richard, and thank you. And I'd like to wish you a Merry Christmas.
I would love to wish you a Merry Christmas, and I hope we don't forget all the other species at that time. You know, we try to avoid eating them, for example, over Christmas.
Richard, it's been so sad to witness, leading up to Christmas, the amount of cattle trucks filled with cows and sheep in particular that have been on the roads and being transported in very hot conditions. And this is because of the demand of people to put meat on their Christmas plates. You know, we exist as a radio program to try and help people make the connection between the meat they buy at the supermarket and the living being who was sacrificed but who didn't want to die.
I'm hoping that we will begin to include the other animals in our community. Mm. We're all part of the same community, community of consciousness, a community of pain, and any other creature that can suffer pain should have our respect. We're all on the same boat.
We're all
suffering together.
We're all suffering together. And just as we look out for other human beings, we need to look out for other animals as well.
In exactly the same way.
We
all have a complex nervous system.
Yes.
We all show avoidance behavior when we're faced with pain. There are good evolutionary reasons why we should experience pain, and the other animals too.
Mm.
So there are very strong scientific reasons to believe that other animals suffer pain and distress in the same sort of way that we do. And we want to try and, not only in our own lives, but to try and get legislation passed.
Yes.
I would like to see, for example, some recognition at the United Nations of a concern for non-human animals. At the moment, the United Nations is entirely a speciesist organization in as much as it seems concerned only about the human animal when there are hundreds of other species that are suffering.
That's a wonderful idea. It's been so wonderful talking to you, Richard. Thank you very much. Have a lovely Christmas and holiday period, and I hope you get some rest and relaxation. And I'll put some links on my Facebook page. Do you have your own web page?
Oh, I'm so old, I can't deal with it all.
77 years young and still going strong. Our thanks to Dr. Richard Ryder, who has done so much in shifting the fundamental paradigm that animals are things, resources, property, for us to do as we wish. So long as animal use is regarded as normal and is not raising a fundamental moral question, nothing will ever change. But the good news is that things are changing, and there is every reason to be encouraged. Well, next time we meet, it will be January, so on behalf of myself and the other team members at Safe and Sound, I'd like to wish you a wonderful, peaceful and compassionate year in 2018. Mā te wā. Bye-bye.